All right, this is tape two, side A. You were talking about these retreats. This is when you're, I assume you're finishing up your Master of Science.
That was throughout, actually. We organized three or four of these, so that...
And you were talking, too, about how ominous the future seemed, or it didn't seem very hopeful. What were the paths that you were looking at? I mean, you had limited possibilities. What were some of those possibilities, though, that you were looking at?
I could stay at Warsaw University. It was not easy, but it looked my professor and people at university were trying to do everything for me to be able to stay. And at the time when I was leaving Poland, it looked that if I would be staying, I would be able just to work at Warsaw University, so teach and do research. So that was the only other option I considered. I did not even think about another option that I could take at the time. I would not take another option, at least at the time.
Right. What was your thesis? What was the thesis? I assume was that the proper name for it?
That's right. Okay. It was a master thesis. I mentioned to you that I studied in a lab which was interested in regulation of gene expression, and this lab was studying a chromatin structure, and chromatin is just the physical status of the genetic material, which is a DNA, and the proteins which are packaging it. Mm-hmm. And at the time, the notion was arising that this physical status of a chromatin of the genetic material very much depends if this material is being expressed or it's being silent in any given cell. And then that's what I've been trying to address, trying to compare what are the differences between this genetic material or its physical status of the material that is currently being expressed versus the one which is silent. So mm-hmm. that was the topic of my thesis, and I was looking at just the properties of how the DNA is packaged in both situations. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right, you get your Master's of Science in 1985, mm-hmm. and then you become a research assistant. Was that immediately afterward then?
That's right. Yeah, so I finished my master's degree, and at the time I was simply waiting for people in U.S. to decide to accept me to their program or not.
Mm-hmm. And where did you apply?
I applied to Madison, Wisconsin for two main reasons. One was that, as I told you, I was already interested very much in developmental genetics and particularly in animal development. Mm-hmm. I applied, but I thought that I might have a better chances of being accepted to a lab which works on a similar subject or in a similar model system that I was working during my master thesis. So I applied to the best lab in the world, working also on the system I used for studies of chromatin structure, which was a slime mold. Mm-hmm. So that lab was in Madison, Wisconsin. However, it was not an accident that the friend I told you about, Helenka, was at the time already married and in U.S. and living in Madison, Wisconsin.
Really?
So that was definitely my interest in Madison, Wisconsin was tripled, if not quadrupled, because for me that was a big step. You know, leaving when you are just 24, to leave your home country. In which I was very much isolated because of just isolation of the whole system,
right.
Except one trip to Portugal and one trip to Ukraine at some point. So that was a big step, and definitely going to a city where my best friend lives, that helped. That reassured me and my family that I will be okay.
Right. And how about at that point, it wasn't your husband, but your boyfriend at that time, I suppose.
My boyfriend at the time was accepted and went to University of Maryland.
Right.
He started to study there, and I started to study in Wisconsin, and we were calling a lot, and we were also writing a lot, and we decided that it might be worthwhile for him to try to transfer, and he did, and from that point we were together.
Right. I want to back up just a little bit, because in looking at your CV, you do a summer research, a pre-doctoral studentship
in Germany.
Right, in Germany. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that and how it fit into your evolution as a scientist.
I was just very curious about the world, and just at the time it was possible for us to travel, and I applied for fellowships, and it was pretty popular at the time for Western Germany to fund just a summer work of people from Eastern Europe. So I applied to a lab which was working on the slime mold I was working on with Poland, and I went there just for a couple of months, which was just an experience in terms of using some of the techniques I was reading about, and just meeting people from a different country. That was a very interesting experience for me as well, reinforcing the idea that I like science for the reasons of science and for the reasons of being able to go to interesting places and meet interesting people.
Right.
It also gave me a courage that, you know, I can go to a place knowing just a little bit of German. I can survive for 2 months in a place like that and work in a different lab. It was also helpful because the professor Thomas Schreckenbach, who was running that lab, he knew my future PhD advisor. And at the end of my stay there, and he was very positive about my stay in the lab, and he was very generous. I came back to Poland with a big stack of books. He asked me what he can do to help me, and I simply said, well, why don't you write to Professor Duff and tell him that you know me, that you've met me, and what type of student I am. Right. And he has done that, and I think that was very helpful, besides my taking GREs, and that also helped eventually when because there was some anticipation. It was pretty unusual at the time for a student from Poland just to write to US and say I want to study there, and they had absolutely no idea what type of preparation I would have, and so there was some anticipation, I think, on his side, should he take that risk and accept me, and definitely besides the GRE tests, the letter from Schreckenbach must have been also just a reassurance and helped in the decision.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, your path that you're taking, I think, is very interesting. Were other people taking any similar paths along those routes?
So that's actually quite interesting question, and it was me and my husband and future husband.
Right.
And just very few people. I'm actually amazed how rarely does it happen that we've met throughout our time here. We've met few Polish students, and I'm just and also from other European countries. Actually, that's very rare for people to come here to do PhD. Mm-hmm. A lot of scientists come here to do postdoctoral work. Maybe this is because it takes such a long time in US to do PhD. In Europe, you can do it in 3 years in some countries. In here, you have to do extensive coursework, and it takes a long time. So maybe that's a reason. But that was pretty unique.
Mm-hmm. When we get further into the interview, I'll ask a little bit of questions about gender in your lab and in your department. But I was thinking, among your cohort at this time in school, I mean, how many women were in trying to pursue graduate careers were also doing this? I realize you can't give me, you know, hard and fast numbers, but nevertheless, what was the percentage?
No, it's actually a very interesting question that I also think sometimes. And again, I think I was raised in a somehow very special circumstance because in this regard, I was indoctrinated in a positive way. I was indoctrinated that I am equal to everybody. And from my family, definitely that came as well. But we were really raised in the spirit of women being equal to men. even though now when I talk with my mom, she was not making as much money as her colleagues. So that was not completely true. But I strongly believed I was equal, and I strongly believe that all the races are equal, and so on and so forth. So I would say that I picked good parts of indoctrination, if you will, and that helped me and still does, I think, throughout my life, that I have no complexes about being a woman. I don't see being mistreated or sometimes you know, maybe not looked seriously as that's the attitude I took with me from Poland. I don't recall ever at school any issues, and they are normal issues between girls and boys and then men and women, but I don't think we ever felt as discriminated, right, or just looked from above by our colleagues.
Right. Okay. I wanted to ask, did you apply at any other places for grad school besides Madison?
Actually, no. So you see, that was a pretty targeted admission.
That's what it sounds like, too. It sounds like you really did set your sights on
it. I have such a good school, too.
Right. Well, let's talk about that school, because you show up at Madison. You eventually go into William Dove's lab. How, describe that transition. What was that like to go from Warsaw
to Wisconsin? In many respects, that was not such a difficult transition. I mean, it was... So there were several aspects. One aspect was just the school itself and language, and there was a language barrier in a sense that at the time I told you that I was mostly learning English on my own by reading, and then for the last few years I also had private conversation lessons, which really helped me to understand and speak a little bit. My understanding ability was very good, excellent. I had no problem with understanding any lectures. I had no problem with reading. My speaking ability was not that great, and that's what I've been struggling for the first few years. And that's difficult because, I mean, I'm not extremely talkative person. I like to talk. I like to communicate my thoughts, and I felt... like my handcuffed, if you will. I could not express myself. I felt stupid. That was difficult. But people were extremely friendly in this regard. Americans are too friendly. They don't correct you. But I was lucky that for 2 years I had a British friend. And she did correct me. That was very helpful. The lab was international. There were some British people, and there were some foreign students, and there were some Polish people in Madison as well. And, of course, there was my friend, Helenka. And with her and her husband, we would very often meet and spend time together. So in this sense, the language, slowly I adjusted to it, and it did not become, it was not a problem. Of course, there's issue of missing your family, and there's issue of missing your country. And the first year is very difficult. And especially when I was leaving Poland, that was 1986, I was not really sure if I can come back. I mean, I actually left very officially, and but we did not know if the system will change, what will happen. So that's why this departure was very difficult, because I was not sure, can I come back after 2 years? Will it take 5 years for me to be able to go back? But fortunately, after 2 years, I was able to go back, and that was that was a very very memorable for me visit. I was so homesick. I was so I was missing Poland so much, and I was coming via train from Germany from some conference, and I remember when I saw the first Polish cow. There was enough. I was just crying. I'm not mentioning my family when I saw them at the train station. But yes, that was that was a difficult time, just missing the family. And as I told you, I had huge stacks of letters from my family at the time.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
But then from then on, once this first visit happened, I knew I can go back, so that helped a lot. Mm-hmm. And somehow then, soon after that, the changes started to happen in Poland, and somehow the communication became easier, and the distance simply became smaller. And now it is very small. It is still the same physical distance, but they are closer than they used to be in 1986 and 1987.
Right, right. How was the system set up at Madison? How did you, in other words, eventually end up at the William Dove Lab?
I went directly to his lab. So that's actually, in most graduate schools, and actually in Madison as well, you can do rotations, and in some departments you have to do rotations. Mm-hmm. You are not allowed to go directly to a given lab. However, they allowed that. If there was a student who from the very beginning was interested in a particular lab, they had no problems with the student joining that lab, so that's what I've done.
Right.
And already at the time I knew that when I finish PhD on a slime mold, I will do animal genetics, but that was okay with me. I mean, I liked the lab very much, and Bill Duff is actually an excellent geneticist, and besides slime molds, he was also doing mouse genetics. So I was exposed all the time to mouse genetics, to vertebrate genetics, mm-hmm. and thinking about vertebrate system. And of course, I had all the coursework I wanted on the subjects that were interesting to me. So I could change the lab after arriving there, but I felt it's not needed, that what PhD is for is to get a good education and a good experience, and then I can do a postdoc in the subject that I will decide will
right.
be for the rest of my life, and mm-hmm. that's what happened.
And you hadn't met, correct me if I'm wrong, but you hadn't met Professor Dove before
no,
you came
I have
there.
Not, no.
So you just had done research on his lab, said that's precisely what I want to do, and then
actually
applied.
The story is even funnier, and that will tell you how naive and how little I knew about the world science. A friend of mine brought a book from an international meeting on the slime mold, Physarum polycephalum in Latin, and I found this article from that lab in Wisconsin, and the first name, the first author was Larry Green. Bill Duff was the last author.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did not know that the lab head is usually the last name, so I wrote a letter to Larry Green. Dear Professor Green, Professor Green turned out to be a graduate student.
He was very flattered.
He was very flattered. So Larry, whom I met later, Larry took this letter to Bill, laughingly telling him, look, there's this woman from Poland who wants to study with me. And Bill responded. Bill was not the only person I wrote. There was actually another... I think Susumu, not Susumu Tonegawa, I don't remember. There was a Nobel Prize winning person there to whom I wrote, working on ribosomes. And I think I wrote to that person because that was a Nobel Prize winning person. And then another person I wrote was a Polish person, a Professor Wacław Szybalski, who studied bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a Polish connection, of course. Professor Szybalski responded as well, but then I decided to go to Bill's lab. But Professor Szybalski was important. Because there was a lab, he was born in Poland, he left Poland much, much earlier in the 50s, but there was usually a number of Polish people in his lab, which was a nice social aspect and they were just a floor above us, so that was nice.
Right, right. Is there much of a Polish community in Madison?
There is, and Polish communities usually have two layers to them. There is so-called the old immigration, and these are people who emigrated, well, any time up to the Great Depression, because mm-hmm. a lot of Poles emigrated at the time. And then there is the immigration from our times. I mean, we left to study, but after the martial law was imposed, a lot of intelligentsia were just allowed to to leave, and many of, or some were asked to leave. They were not wanted in that country. So many people emigrated at the time all right. over the world. So there were these two waves, and we, you know, we interacted with both of them.
Mm-hmm. Did you plan when you came over here to do both graduate work? I assume you were thinking of doing your postdoc here as well in the U.S.?
No. As I told you, I sort of went from step to step and never had a grand plan for my life. I became interested in biology, so I went to Warsaw to study. Then I decided, you know, I fell in love with developmental genetics and science in general, so I decided to go to graduate school to U.S. And then I kept all my options open, even though I knew that it probably a very likely possibility will be that I will do postdoctoral work, and that there will be a likely event that I'll simply stay in this country. But that was never planned. That was, you know, let's do this. And partly because I didn't know how well I will do in graduate school. What, you know, will I like this country? Will I like doing science in this country? So I simply did not make any firm plans.
Right. Okay. Before we get into that work that you do, how about American culture itself? Had you been prepared at all for this? I mean, how much of American culture, I guess, was there in Poland when you were going through the university?
So when we talked about the transitions, I talked about language and I talked about missing Poland. There is a big, one of the biggest, say, culture shocks, if you will, is in the relationships with people. I mean, Poles and generally Europeans are extremely close to one another. We form friendships and we form very close friendships. And with friends, we talk about everything. We become attached to one another. And that may be because we are very stationary in Europe. Now this is changing with Europe, European Union. People start traveling for jobs. In Poland, the situation was somewhat extreme because it was difficult to move, because it was difficult to get apartments. So you had apartment in that place and you stayed your whole life in that place. That's mm-hmm. very simple, right? And once you do this, you form these friendships and you form bonds for your whole life, okay? And then once you leave, if you happen to leave, which happens rarely, you miss your friends. You miss not only your family, but you miss your friends. What struck me when I came to U.S. is, on one hand, that everybody is extremely nice, and Poles are a little bit gloomy and pessimistic, and they like to complain, and that strikes me especially when I go back to Poland. But when I came here, what was very nice and striking was how nice everybody is and smiling and how are you and so on. But then there is this realization that everybody is nice, but everything, that all of this is very shallow. Mm-hmm. That, you know, if somebody asks how are you, so if somebody asked me how are you at the beginning, I would stop, because that's what Polish person would do, and try to explain my condition. Well, that's a normal thing for Europeans, and you learn very quickly that how are you is just good morning almost, and you move on. But then even if you go beyond that and you have some friends in the lab, I felt that there is almost like a glass between me and my American colleagues, that there is somehow this barrier that I cannot reach through, that there is almost, there is this perception that Americans like their personal space. In terms of do not touch, and of course Europeans, you know, we hug, we kiss, we do all these things, I know that Americans do not like these things in everyday life, but then it's almost, I felt that there's almost, not only in physical sense, but also in emotional sense, that there's almost the same type of need of isolation and not getting through. So that's at least was perception at the time. and I have a theory about it as well. And my theory is that this is almost a self-defense of becoming too attached, because if you become attached, then you miss people.
Right.
So I felt, because I went from Madison, I went to Boston, and from Boston I came here, and at every place I met people and I became attached to some of them, and then I missed them. And so now I now know that you cannot get too attached, because then you miss people. But now I very much appreciate the style of life that science gives in terms of traveling and moving from place to place, which is a very American style of life, is that, you know, once you get over missing somebody you recognize the positive side of it, and that I have friends all over the world.
Right.
And that's what I very much enjoy. And whenever I go to Europe, you know, I have friends in Paris, I have friends in Germany, I have friends in London, in Madrid, and basically everywhere. And with, of course, it's a very, very big circle of friends. And we don't talk every week. We don't sometimes even speak every month, but we usually see one another every year or every second year. So that's my theory about
the
glass wall.
It's like a defense mechanism for a very highly mobile population. Interesting.
Well, there's another theory, is that which is age related. I think that, you know, the type of very close friendships that people do form really happen in high school and at university, and later people become so involved in their own life that these very close friendships are no longer happening.
Right. At Madison, let's talk a little bit about the work that you do there. What was the strategy, or rather, how did you and Bill Dove decide upon what your first couple of projects would be? Did you come in already very clearly knowing what you wanted to do?
Dalap was doing many things, but he knew I was interested in development. As simple as slime mold is, it actually has some developmental aspects. So he allowed me to work on that developmental aspect, and so I did what I wanted to do, in terms that I was able to use genetics, and I was able to learn molecular biology techniques and cytological techniques as well. So I was really allowed a choice of what I wanted to do.
And how would you describe his lab management style?
At the beginning, mentoring style in general, mentoring style in a sense that Bill was not doing experiments on his own. After going on sabbatical, he did started to do some experiments, like one day per week. So that was very much a style of meeting with a student or a postdoc and discussing the strategies, discussing experiments. And that's what eventually we arrived at. At the very beginning, he was trying to get to know me, and that sometimes was frustrated to me, I felt that he just didn't realize that my education was much better than the questions he was asking me.
See.
But that was just the first few meetings, and after meetings, and after that, I think we got into a very good relationship.
Was he someone who, I don't want to say micromanage, but, you know, tried to keep sort of tabs on progress every day of all of the members of his lab? He had a very small lab, too, didn't he, to begin with?
That was not a very big lab, but it was about 10 people or so.
Oh.
And it was not a small lab. It was, and he had the part of the lab that was working on the slime molds, and then the part of the lab that was working on the mouse. And at the time when I was there, both parts were still pretty sizable. That he was not an everyday manager, or he was not He was not really pushing me. Mm-hmm. He was very concerned. He really took seriously our education. So that was his primary, I would say, goal. That he really cared that we learn. And during our conversations, he spent a lot of time on thinking about proper controls, for proper understanding of the subject, proper scientific method. So that was very important.
Right. Describe, if you would, what was the evolution of your research that you did during the, 5 years?
Mm-hmm.
5 years that you were there, almost six.
That's right. So we started, there's a very simple transition developmental process that happens. Physarum can exist as a single-celled organism, which we call amoebae, and then it can become a multicellular cell, which we call syncytium. Mm-hmm. And the syncytium was interesting for scientists at the time because all these nuclei can undergo cell division or mitosis in a synchronous fashion. So it was in a way devised as a model for regulation of cell cycle. I was interested on how the single cell becomes this big cell, single cell with a single nucleus, how does it become this syncytium? And there are many intracellular changes that happen, the cytoskeleton changes during that transition, and the way how a nucleus, how the chromosomes divide, also change in a very characteristic fashion. So that was my task. My question was to ask how this process happens, what are the genes that are involved in regulation of that process. And I addressed that at many different levels. So there was one very descriptive aspect of the work in which I used the techniques to basically describe what happens with the skeleton of a cell, with the microtubules, how do they change when there is just a single cell, what are the characteristics of a cell that has already two nuclei in it and then hundreds and so on and so forth. So that was cell biological approach, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Then we also used a genetic approach. We had a collaboration with a lab in UK where they isolated a number of mutants defective in that process. So we were characterizing these mutants in terms of what goes wrong with the development, and that for me was a strategy that I wanted to use in the future to address animal development, find defective individuals and ask at what point in development are they defective, isolated gene that is responsible for the defect. So that was another avenue that we were pursuing. And then finally, the last approach, we decided to use molecular methods and basically isolate, using these molecular methods, genes that would be either turned off or turned on at these specific stages of development. So all in all, actually, that provided a very nice combination, very nice educational package, because I was working with genetic methods, I learned cell biological methods, and I also learned molecular biology methods. So that was extremely useful. Even when I came here, because during my postdoctoral work, I did a huge project, but this project was very limited in terms of methods we've been using. So this experience from my graduate school actually was very, very important in terms of my ability to do what we have done here, which is to use many, many methods. And part of that education from Wisconsin was invaluable at the time.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Now, compare, if you would, the labs. Let's say the lab that you were in Warsaw and the one in Wisconsin. What was the difference?
Mm-hmm. There is a huge difference in terms of just equipping the labs. It's the possibilities of doing experiments in Wisconsin are just completely different than they were in Poland. There is also a difference in terms of how much time scientists can spend, can commit in Poland to doing science, and they can in US. And the difference comes from a very prosaic reason, is that the salaries of scientists in Poland were and still are pitiful. Mm-hmm. So most of my colleagues, even now, who are at Warsaw University and became professors since then, they usually have to do additional jobs to be able to live. Right. So they teach, they translate, they write books. So effectively, you know, the intensity of work in Poland was smaller, except that you had students like us who, of course, would spend strange hours in the lab. But most of scientists would be spending smaller number of hours, and then of course in Wisconsin, where there was just much higher intensity of effort mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. You have several publications. What was the publication? What was the journal writing process, I guess, in Dove's lab? How did you go about starting a paper and getting it through all of these stages?
So from the very beginning, I was allowed to write papers on my own, which was very valuable experience. And Bill was extremely patient in terms of my English. And so writing would be... very much starting, you know, with a body of work, and us thinking about, okay, we have a body of work that can be described in a manuscript, and writing an outline. I think that's exactly what I'm doing with my people right now. That's mm-hmm. the sort of the system that we were working with Bill, writing an outline and collecting the images, because in biology this visual data or numerical data are extremely important. So we would have the data collected and the outline, and once this was ready, then one could write results based on the data. And I would write results, and he would read them, and then I would write introduction, and then discussion. So that was very much back and forth effort. I would mm-hmm. write, and he would read it, and then other colleagues in the lab would read it. So that's a very common technique. I mean, mm-hmm. some labs, some PIs like to write their papers, but as I told you, for Bill, our education was very important, and he wanted us to, from the very beginning, to learn to write our own papers.
Right. Now, did you know at this point? I know that you said earlier that you sort of were just taking sort of steps mm-hmm. and feeling your way. Were you having any thoughts about having your own lab, or setting up your own lab, or was that again just too far in the future?
I mean, of course I had thoughts. I mean, it's not that, yes, I've been feeling my way through, but I knew what the possibilities were at the time. It's that I don't think I ever motivated myself in a sense that, you know, I have to do well here because I want to have my own lab in the future. Somehow my motivation always was just I want to do great science, and everything else is sort of a byproduct of I mean, all these other administrative things, you know, your own lab, the promotions, all of that is sort of like a byproduct of doing science, of being engaged in science.
Right. What was the most important discovery that you made in the lab?
Probably important in a sense
important
that...
For you,
important for me,
yeah.
Because it was really the first discovery, almost important discovery that I have done during PhD. I told you that I was interested in genetic regulation of the developmental process. And we knew from studies in other labs that there is one gene that is turned on, and they had some concept when this gene is turned, this protein actually, because we had antibodies, when this is turned on, and that was pretty late during this developmental process. And from my thinking about it, I knew that this protein should be turned on earlier. And I was able to do an experiment, and it was a long experiment, because it started with me optimizing conditions of the culture and being able to enrich in certain developmental stages. But eventually I was able to show that this protein that others thought is shows up only at pretty late stage of development, I could already identify it when this single nucleus cell became a binucleate cell. Mm-hmm. So it was a very simple observation. But for me, seeing this spot showing up on this sheet of Western blot, as we call it, was an amazing feeling, you know. Oh. And that's what science is all about.
Mm-hmm. How much in especially with regard to your work, how much of your work has relied or depended upon creativity, scientific creativity?
It always is. I think how much you get, how big progress you achieve in any given project, that's very much dependent, because you will always get somewhere, you will do something, right. But what you can do with that project is very much dependent on your creativity, and in a way, the fact that I told you that detection of that little spot of that protein very much first relied on fooling around with conditions of culture, mm-hmm. and that's probably what, you know, maybe not everybody would have done that, and that's probably what it's maybe creativity or at least curiosity or just thinking a little bit out of the box is that, you know, what else can I do to address this question, or if somebody failed to do something, what, you know, what could have they missed, what else can I think about to succeed in answering specific question.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because it seems, I mean, a question that I often have is what is scientific creativity? And it seems part of it is that, again, that urge, that the desire to go beyond sort of the paradigms, the models mm-hmm. that we've been presented with, or maybe techniques that we know now. What else can we add? But is there anything else, I guess? Also hard work, it just seems to me, going that extra.
Hard work is important, but probably, you know, especially in the type of work I'm doing, is ability to observe nature. Biology, in a way, is describing what nature is and what are mechanism of how nature works. Mm-hmm. And I think, I not consider myself extremely gifted person, but I know that I have some abilities, maybe different than some other people have. And if I can point to something or some people have in biology, is this ability and patience to observe the process that you are studying. Really watch it. Watch it very carefully, and you'll have five different scientists watching, for example, how a cell moves, mm-hmm. which now for me it's important in my research, or just watch this process happening, either in motion or simply, you know, at few time points. And then you will have these five different scientists, and if you ask them, you know, what have you seen, they will all tell you different things. And some people have ability to see certain details that maybe other people would ignore, but they actually notice that, and they then start asking questions about it, and then that's where sometimes discovery comes from.
Right.
So it's not mathematics, it's not, you know, creating something completely new, but in the parts of, in the discipline of biology that I am in, the observation and curiosity and being able to notice something and dwell on it, that's a very important aspect of the discovery.
Right. Mm-hmm. Just to see what there is to be seen.
That's right.
Although it sounds
simple,
mm-hmm. it's really difficult, it seems. Mm-hmm. Someone once said, that science is mostly trained, and I quote, mostly trained in organized common sense. Mm-hmm. You agree or disagree with that?
Trained and organized common sense. Depending what you consider common sense.
Right.
But yes, if you consider a common sense a belief that, that biology works by laws of physics, yes.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Huh, okay. All right. Describe, sort of getting back again here. Mm-hmm. Let me flip this over, actually.